Ulva are a fascinating band. Their name means wolf in Norwegian, which is their home country. They grew out of the black metal scene in Norway and have been on this incredible journey since then. They've worked with the Norwegian National Orchestra up to their current sound, which is this kind of like deep, dark electronic music. All their albums also come with a fascinating array of topics and subject matter, which the lead man, Christopher, explains in this interview. Point you got to now, this is really fascinating point, because you've almost, and with the recent cover of the Frankie song, it's quite interesting because it puts what you're doing to this really odd context. You've almost become like a mid-80s Trevor Horn style, one of the pinnacles of pop in a way, you know, that those incredible productions and that incredible sound, those records. Now, is this something you've been fascinated by? Yeah. Is that kind of sound something you've been fascinated by?
Yeah, it's, well, I suppose it's the sound we grew up with, you know, being born in 76. It's in many ways the sound of my my childhood, you know. So it's that kind of, you know, the big pop sound of the 80s and you know, the sort of emotional attachments of that music as well has lingered on, you know, in the back of the mind. And also sort of, I guess, socially in a way, it's... We'd always go back there, you know. Throughout these years, we've been doing very different kinds of music, but I guess just came to a point where, you know, it made sense to tackle those musical emotions. I guess you can say to some extent.
So in a way, the alpha music, you know, the first type of music that really forms somebody. For you, was that period that you know, the almost very polished, supremely orchestral kind of pop of people like Trevor Horn.
Yeah, well, I know Trevor Horn, but I didn't really know who he was until the 90s. But yeah, I guess, you know, Frankie, Talk, Kid. But you know, there are a few sort of artists and releases from that time that stood the test of time better, I think.
Just about the journey, you know, and it's interesting because it's the formative music, but it's the one you've kind of gone the whole circle back to.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, actually. I mean, towards the end of the 80s, obviously, you know, I was a teenager and then came punk rock and sort of, well, I guess metal, and in our late teens, that's when we actually started the band, that's where we were at, you know. So obviously in the early 90s and on, it was maybe a bit embarrassing to be yeah, into that 80s. Yeah. But all these things go in circles, you know. So it goes in and out of vogue, and obviously this whole 80s thing has been quite popular in recent years. But it's I feel it's somehow tackled a bit like it's an exercise in being niche, if you know what I mean. It's sort of too synthesized or too sort of like a pastiche of this time or this sound. So what we tried to do with the last album, I think, is to sort of be reverent to it, but also bring in very recent sort of productional values, or, you know, also very kind of Ulver-esque things into the mix, you know, that are maybe not so directly 80s or what have you.
Oh, yeah, because it does not sound completely like a record from that time.
That wasn't the aim either, yeah. I would say. You know, it's more of a, you know, it's more a sort of emotional reverence, I guess, to that kind of, that music and the sort of grandness of it, I suppose, which obviously being a bit pompous isn't something we're afraid of.
Yeah, well,
it's something we rather like.
Yeah, well, you know, when people call things pretentious, that's a compliment.
Yeah. Oh, it certainly can be. At least in our book, it can be a compliment. So,
because you've been on a long journey since you first heard that music in the '80s, it does change the inflections of it, doesn't it, when you make it now? Because one thing I've always found fascinating about all.
That kind of goes back to what I was saying. I think a lot of these people who do this sort of nostalgic music now, they're maybe, it's just a guess, but my guess is that they're quite much younger than we are. So they weren't actually around when that music came out, you know. So that's a point, actually. I'm thinking of this, you know, so-called synth wave genre and all this, you know, Stranger Things and all that. That kind of soundtracky, nostalgic, electronic music and such. It's a bit different from The Assassination of Julius Caesar or the EP, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I don't know if I just make this up in my head when I listen to it, but I could definitely feel the shadow or the echo of your first album still in your music now. It's still in the DNA of it. Is that something you're conscious of, or is it something that doesn't really matter?
You're not the first one to point out that there has been a sort of popish sensibility in everything we've done, even the metal stuff, you know, had more dreamy, or how should we say, almost sort of pop sensibility to it, to a small extent, obviously, but still might be the case, but it's. I wouldn't say it's a conscious thing. It's more embedded in the blood, in the DNA, probably.
Yeah, because even on the earlier stuff you do that I've heard, it's your vocals are still quite similar. You've never been one for shouting. It's always been this. I mean, you've got a great singing voice, and you've used that right from the start.
I did scream a bit on the first record and the third record, but then I kind of just decided that it wasn't for me, really. Even if I guess I pulled it off, but I felt more comfortable with the so-called clean singing style. It's more me, I suppose.
And it's interesting now when if I go back to listen to your early records, it kind of changes the way they sound. In my head, after listening to your later ones, it's almost kind of remix the earlier ones. I mean, does that happen to you as well? Or I mean, I know most people in bands don't listen to their records that much, but does it change your aspect on your earlier music, the way you're working on your later music?
Well, I mean, maybe not in the way that you just described, but my personal attachment to the music changes. My personal liking of certain things, you know, my own appreciation of it will change with time, but I'm not sure if that's down to how the music somehow changes with time, you know. It does. I mean it's a very subjective thing, listening to music, you know, and it's attached to memories and all that. So
I mean, you followed a very honest path in music, I think. I totally understand with most musicians, they find something they're good at and the audience is comfortable with, and they stay there even if they're really bored of it, but it's kind of an okay lifestyle, et cetera, et cetera. But you've taken fantastic swerves all the time. You know,
they just love that one thing so much.
That could be true as well. But I mean, do you find you're a person that gets, if you get into something, do you get completely obsessed with it, you know? You just happily go in one direction, and then someone gives you a cassette with coil on the other side of it, and suddenly you go down the coil rabbit hole.
yeah, that's more akin to how we would operate. I think that, you know, it's so tied to, you know, making an album. It's a lot of work, and it's a lot of, you know, blood, sweat, and tears, so to speak, that goes into it. And for us, I think it's just the most natural thing in the world to want to go somewhere a bit different the next time, you know.
I mean, it's a deliberate process. Would you seek out things to give you a curveball, or do the curveballs just come naturally? You know, like I said about.
I do think they tend to come naturally. You know, you might spend a year making an album, and it's quite deep into one. You know, one sort of aesthetic, or you know, a sort of productional angle, or an idea that you have, and as you say, there might come a few curveballs along the way, and you might, how shall one put that, savor that, or put it to the side, but take that out the next time you know, reconvene and discuss what to do, or you know, it's more those sort of things at play. You know?
I guess
it's difficult to explain, but yeah,
it's just it's quite fascinating for a listener, you know, to see. The things that have happened, I mean, there are certain, I mean, I'm guessing here, but there's certain key points that were big sort of, you know, signposts in your direction, you know, like the 80s music you got into when you're very young. And then when you go, a couple of years later, it's punk rock than death metal. And then the moment you walk into Helvet, that's a defining moment, isn't it, really? Like, it's a crossroads where you could go one way or the other.
Absolutely, because that's a sort of a narrowing world in a way. You know, you're walking into a very small world in many ways, and a lot happened as a result of that. The whole, you know, black metal thing, and but you know that only really lasted for, well, let's say 4 or 5 years, and then it got kind of oversaturated. I would say that scene, too many people wanted in on it, I suppose, and you know, so it's quite a natural thing to break away from as well. And now we're in what, the late 90s, you know, then we started toying with more electronic processes, and really that was the second really defining moment when Tore Ylvisaker came in as well, and he was quite adept at working with samplers and things like this, and that really changed the whole direction of the band and opened up a lot of possibilities, I would say, in the studio and things like that, and it's been sort of going from there, really.
Why did you bring him in? Did you bring Tove in as a deliberate process to break away from the traditional kind of rock format?
Or was it not really? No, we just met in a studio, actually in the studio where we recorded the second album, the acoustic album we did. I met him there like a year later while I was working with another band, and it's quite a natural thing. We started first talking about talking about him doing some remixes, and in that process I was sort of taking part in that, and we hit it off, you know, and that's really the whole story, and it's quite a natural thing from both people, I think, that we wanted to do something together, and that became, after a lot of work, the double album based on William Blake's The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, which we worked on for a year or maybe more, he's been in ever since.
So none of these moves are ever deliberate curveballs. It's just you bump into somebody, you hear something, you get obsessed with something, and it just takes on that journey. Yeah,
things happen along the way. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, so you don't really operate. Ulva doesn't operate like a band, does it? Or does it operate like a band sort of format?
It kind of does, but a band with a sort of extended family, I would say. We have a few friends who might be, you know, very into this or that idea, and sometimes, you know, we'll have this or that guy come in and help us through some process, you know, and maybe the next project some other friends might fit better, but there's always has been for, you know, a long time, a sort of a core membership, you know, in the band. So it's more like a band with branches.
and a lot of the records they come
fickle about that, but you know, it's this guy, even, you know, I don't have to play on this, or it's more about being together and creating something together as a group of friends, you know, like I guess you're in a band, so you know how it works.
So
it's not like, you know, we did a lot of things where, you know, I didn't really sing on many things that we did, and Tore did a lot of the actual sort of programming, and I was sort of pacing around the room and, oh, what about this, what about, you know, so it's a bit differs from time to time, sort of how we do things productionally, it doesn't really matter, because what's important is getting a good result, I think, or an interesting result, or
I mean, it's such a different dynamic working with loops and programs, isn't it? Did that take quite a lot to change the way you thought about creating music, or did it just seem completely seamless? You know, he came up with a great loop, great set of beats.
Well, the album that really changed Ulver, I think, in that respect, is the Blake album, where we still, a lot of these, the guys that were part of the first, the sort of metal Ulver, if you will, they were part of that creative process, but I guess also during the process, it became quite clear that Tore and I, we found a method to work after, which was just, as you said, went into that rabbit hole, so it was a sort of natural revelation of a new way to work, I guess.
One thing that's always really interesting on records as well is the overriding theme. You know, the William Blake theme is that another rabbit hole you went down as well? You found about William Blake, got immersed in it, and it kind of became a whole album, or?
Yeah, it just really spoke to me, I would say, this when I read this this text, which is still, you know, an amazing piece, you know, But it made a lot of sense to me at the time, because it tackles this sort of limbo personal space or relation to, you know, to the biggest possible things, to God and Satan and humanity and religion and so considering where we'd just been in this sort of, how shall we say, Christian negation space, you know, it did speak to me, you know. I guess you could call this text a sort of heretical text.
Yeah,
so it's Christian heretical text in a way, and that made a lot of sense to me emotionally at the time. You know, so I guess that's the story, really. That's quite intuitive. The meeting with Blake's writing, really. So I just figured, let's do something to this. It's that simple.
Obviously, yes, it's affecting the lyrics and the overriding concept of the album, but does it affect the music as well? Does it make you kind of make the music have a certain grandeur to it? Or
I know what you mean. I think we'd probably solve that a different way if we tried it again now. I think it would probably, we'd work harder to actually marry the music and the text in a way. I don't think, trying to remember, but and it's been a long time since I listened to that record, but I do remember thinking sometime in hindsight that it doesn't always reflect too well. The musical sensibility doesn't always match the lyrical sensibilities too well. I think that's more down to youth and hubris, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's already
it's the sort of whims and follies that were going on at the time. So I think if we'd done it again, we'd probably respond to it in a very different way musically, and solve it differently, I think. I'm not saying it's just a sort of exercise of the mind to I'm not saying that we're going to do it. But I'm just thinking it's interesting to think about that. It would obviously be something very different if we started reading that again, getting into it and thinking, okay, how should we sort of underscore this textual vision, you know. It's also a graphic vision, of course, but in that context, it's more of a, it's a long text, you know.
And up to this point, you'd never played live either, had you?
No, we didn't until almost 10 years later, actually.
So what, is that just because you were so busy creating the music you hadn't got around to playing live, or was it a deliberate decision not to play live?
Yeah, it was kind of both. But firstly, I think it's more down to the fact that we were just quite happy being in the studio and being sort of curled up in it, and sort of the hermetic aspect of it as well, you know. Because playing live is many ways a big distraction from, at least from making records and being in that focused studio space, you know. So it wasn't easy not to play live from a financial perspective, but we sort of made do for a long time, and so I guess you could say we were in a quite privileged position that we didn't really have to play live. And then obviously by 2009 there were a lot of things that happened in the music industry and record sales and things. So there was an aspect of we have to do this, you know, to survive as a band. So that's the sort of very, I guess, mundane demystifying of that that choice that we made to play live, you know. But that also bore interesting fruits, I would say.
It's quite fascinating. Yeah.
After we sort of accepted the challenge, you know. So and it redefined the band again, and now it is actually 10 years later. We're a very different band thanks to the fact that we started playing live, I would say.
Yes, I mean it's really interesting because most bands define themselves as what they are, and also musically by playing live. You know, people try the songs out live, see what works, what doesn't work. It totally defines the creative direction. But you've done it. You've kind of done it back to front. So, do you think that's been an aspect that's been important in the overall journey? This thing that you didn't play live for such a long time.
It really did. It allowed us a certain freedom to make quite crazy things in the studio. You know, like thinking in particular of the album Blood Inside, for example, which we actually tried. You know, we played a couple of those tracks live, but they're very difficult to translate to a live setting, and so we've kind of abandoned that now. We even talked about it recently. Could we pull off any of those tunes, you know, but then we just decided, nah, let's leave that and focus on something, because it's crazy in a way, you know, from a sort of conventional playing an instrument perspective. So in that sense, you know, we never took the live environment into consideration ever in those years. And obviously now we do, you know, if we make something that we know is going to be very difficult to pull off live, we might have a debate about it, at least, you know.
Yeah.
Whether to move ahead with it or not. So I'm not saying that we don't make it difficult for ourselves, but yeah, you know what I mean.
So, oh, yeah. I mean, when you play the first gig after all that time and quite a lot of different directions a band's been through, how do you actually decide what over is live? I mean, it's not like a rock band just goes on stage and they just sort of knock it together. I mean, which over, do you have to sit down and work out which over is going to appear at the first gig? I mean, is it going to be like, you could even go like the psychedelic version of over, the Shadows of the Sun version, or...
I know what you mean. Well, I think it was fairly obvious that we weren't going to play, you know, the black metal stuff. Because by the time we said yes to playing live, we were a very different band. And so that kind of was quite natural to put to the side. And then I guess what we did do was put together a sort of anthological set spanning from the Blake album to up into and including Shadows of the Sun, you know, and some EPs and some film stuff we'd made. And so it was a sort of anthological presentation. We had to alter a lot of things, and we also, you know, obviously being quite apprehensive about being on the stage, we decided that we needed something to hide behind. So we put a lot of time into all these massive projections that we had going on a big screen behind us, and we sort of toned down all the lights and stayed back back on stage in the dark, and you know, so we started there, and it's become probably a bit more extrovert with time and with live experience.
And for you as a singer, did you have to learn how to front the band, or do you think, well, actually, I don't want to be a frontman. I'll just, because you do tend to stand back a bit, don't you? Yeah, that's why I like that. I like that. It's quite, because again, yeah, it's like a deconstruction.
Yeah, I like being in the sort of in the hub of it more. I don't like to. It doesn't come natural to me, at least, to front the band. Although I have to some extent now. But
when you perform live, is it more about, you know, like the whole experience? You say like the films. It's immersive, isn't it? Because for the audience, it's not like, in a way, it's not watching people performing, is it? It's, you are actually immersed in this sort of incredible sound. Is that kind of the idea, of what you'd play when you play live, and what you'd be doing in New York as well?
Well, what we're going to do in New York is do the same thing that we've done here in Europe quite a lot last year and the year before. So it's going to be the Caesar show, basically, which is quite conventional, I would say, from a sort of rock perspective. Obviously, it's the big laser show going on. But to go back a bit, we've also done, you know, we did a special show out at something called the Henny Onstad Arts Center. We sat inside a cube, like a square with, what do you call that, scrim screen?
Oh, I saw that on YouTube,
like,
yeah.
Four projectors, and it became yet another way to sort of hide in the midst of things, if you will, you know, like we're still trying to redirect the attention a bit away from us as individuals and what the individual function is. I think it's not that interesting to us. It's more about trying to create, as you said, an immersive sort of environment, or to try to set like a tangible mood on the space you're in, you know.
And why do you concentrate on the Julius Caesar album? Because it's obviously the most recent work, or
that's down to practical things. Like that's where we've been at for the last couple of years. You know, it's the material we've been playing, and it's also quite, you know, it's got a certain aesthetic, and so it would feel kind of strange for us to stray away momentarily from that during a gig. You know, like, okay, let's play one or two or three old numbers would feel like digression or something, you know.
Yeah, because they don't fit musically or into the...
It's a bit about that, I think. Being all in the space we're in now, not worrying so much about I guess it's an aspect of pleasing the audience that, you know, a lot of people might come that haven't seen Ulve before. They wish they heard, you know, this or that. But I think, hopefully they'll forgive us for being a bit non-compromising on that.
I think people embrace that in this context. But the album's like so hypnotic. I mean, so again, that album, it's got a concept. Is it concept, or is that such a 70s word? But it's got an idea. It's got a narrative, a thread, hasn't it?
It has a clear-cut concept. That would be giving that idea too much weight, I think. But
one track that alludes to Lady Diana as well, isn't there?
Yeah. There's some England in there as well, which has been, you know, going back to Wars of the Roses and all that. You know, it's that's going on as well.
Do you have a fascination with England and English culture, or
well, strangely enough, not so much as maybe the to. It just keeps coming back, you know, these, if it's British royalty or what it is, it just happens. I'm not sure I have any good explanation as to why that is, but
just certain aspects of the culture.
Of the culture.
Yeah, I mean, your guess is as good as mine. What we might write about next time we sit down and try to write something, you know, it might be something that happened in England at some point. You know, it's hard to say.
So again, it's like obsessions, but you know, these. It's not like an overriding arch album concept or whatever.
No, it's just listening to things that pop up, you know, in the process. I think more than anything else, we never really. Well, usually we start with a very simple thing. It can be a painting, or it can be something that we want to say something about. And often what we do is see, I guess you could say, parallels. We look for things that we can link from different sources or different places, and that's what we usually do. We would, you know, we just write down lots of different things, and then we see what talks to each other, I guess you can say.
So it's almost like a deliberate colliding of different ideas to see what sparks come off.
It's like a, I guess you could call it, textual montage.
It's quite fascinating, though. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting to do as well. You know, it's aside from being in the studio and making the music, it's something that Jørn and I usually do together. We just have these evenings, and we'll just sit and write lots of stuff down and see how it lines up. And you know, we might get sent off on reading about, you know, some can be whatever, but something happened at a certain date or in a year or in a place, and oh, that's interesting. And you know, if you look at what's going on here, and yeah.
I mean, I don't think there's any song I've ever seen of yours that's ever been about nothing, really. I mean, there's not many bands have a song about the myth of Diana, is there? You know, that's what a fascinating thing. I mean, something that could be really badly written about, but you make it really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, that lyric actually first started with the name itself, you know, Diana, and Artemis, you know, the Greek goddess that the Romans called Diana. And I can't remember why. I think it was actually the morbidly enough, the death aspects, the collision in Paris that sort of entered the picture at some point. And then, you know, it became this strange marriage of things, harkening back to you know, Nemorelia and the Lake of Diana and Diana, Princess of Wales, and all these things sort of speaking to each other.
You know, I don't know if it's something that people always think, you know, that people always think living in apocalyptic times, but it just seemed to accelerate that process in the last few years. And is that something you reflected in the album as well?
I guess it's an ongoing process, the apocalypse.
Is that something that's, on the album, The Assassination, is that something that's sort of reflected in quite a few of the songs in the album? That not directly alluded to, but that just capturing that atmosphere of the times, uncertainty, melancholy.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, we're quite comfortable on the suggestive plane. You know, it's not, there's no ideology here. You know, there's no message. It's more, yeah, just tapping into things. You know, historical things or modern things, or so it's more emotional or associative thing more than trying to, you know, say something directly about.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. They're not. I mean, they're not. They're not statements. It's poetic, isn't it? It's it's creating atmospheres, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an exercise in a way, as much textually as it is musically. You know, it's sort of an exercise.
And the records always have like really interesting artwork as well. Like, so the last album, it's like a sculpture on the cover. And again,
it is a sculpture. It's a detail of a sculpture. Yeah.
And is that just playing with him? Is that juxtaposing images against the lyrical content, to create sparks?
Oh, it's just a fantastic. It's a detail from a sculpture that we loved, and we were just looking at it and simply decided that's the cover. And I did read some, I guess you could call it criticism later, due to the fact that the image itself has nothing to do with the title. But then my response is like, well, does everything have to be illustrative?
You know?
We have to have someone stabbing Caesar on the cover.
Yeah.
So that's a quite simple way to think about, again, back to being a bit suggestive, I guess. That's the simple story behind that. It's actually the same thing that happened back in 2006, I guess that would have been, when we came across this photo that we used for Shadows of the Sun. It was much the same thing, very, very instinctive meeting with an image that spoke to us, and we just decided that's the cover. It's that simple, really.
I mean, surely anybody who knows anything about what you do would not expect a picture of Julius Caesar on the cover of the album, would they?
Well, I like to think not.
Yeah. What I love about your records is that on one level you're drawn in because the music works fantastically and the atmospheres are so great. But then there's all these other little layers underneath of all these almost conflicting images and ideas and little lyrical ideas. And the idea of the artwork doesn't fit in with the album title, but it's fascinating. What is it? You're trying to piece together in your head. Of course you get it all wrong, but that doesn't matter either, because that's part of the trip, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, but it's much the same for us, you know, and back to what I was saying, it's an associative thing. And that's why I'm, you know, it's difficult for me to explain why do we choose this or that, or why do we omit this, or, you know, because it's quite intuitive.
Oh yeah, I'm not even
textually, you know. So it's just as much about looking at things and listening to things for us as well, you know, and discovering how shall we say, it's a rather pretentious way of putting it, but how new spaces sort of open up through that, you know.
So sometimes you could be as baffled by the trip as anybody else.
I think so, yeah.
I mean, obviously you don't really know now, but where can this go next? I mean, it seems to me, as an observer, an outside observer, you've got the live show, you can actually do the live gigs now, so you seem to have spent a bit more time playing gigs.
Yeah, but not too much, though. We're not one of those bands that want to do, you know, we don't really want to play live all the time. We'd rather do it for a bit and then withdraw for some time, you know, and do something else. So I don't know at this point. I think, yeah, we might take a break from gigs again come summer or something, and put ourselves back into the can, so the studio can, you know.
Yeah.
So I think that'll be good for the band. I have an idea, but I don't think I want to say anything.
Oh, no. I'll maintain the mystery. Because the last release, the Sick Trance Gloria Mundi EP, they're just tracks from the album, aren't they? They're just tracks didn't get onto the album. It was just...
Not fully, though. I mean, we did work on them after they were just sort of demos or ideas, really. But so nothing that we actually... We hadn't finished those songs and then thrown them to the side, but the story is that there were sort of demos we had from the Caesar sessions, and we picked them up again in the, when was that, summer of 2017?
Yeah,
basically after the first gigs we played, we we went and we did Roadburn, and then we did Greece, and we flew to Tasmania, of all things, and did the Dark Mofo Festival and possibly some other concerts. I can't remember. Then we had some time, and you know, we just, it's kind of, in a way, it was a sort of a surplus project. So we just decided to pick up some loose ends that we had from Caesar and complete them. So yeah, that's what. Yeah. Obviously, we wrote the lyrics then that summer. We didn't have lyrics or anything, but that's the story of the EP.
Okay. I think I've got everything I need there, Chris. Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool.